Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Charles Hamilton, representing erstwhile plaintiff and now appellant, Mr. Christopher Parsons. I wonder if I could reserve 3 minutes of time, please. This case involves an order granting summary judgment, and the court reviews the entirety of the record de novo.
Counsel, we discussed this case yesterday afternoon, as we discuss all cases. Let me ask you some questions. There's a motion to strike the pleading in the record of your motion for reconsideration below, and you didn't respond to that. And my question is this. Did the trial court ever rule on that motion?
No. Counsel is correct for reasons which I can't explain. The motion was not served within 10 days.
So the court never ruled on that?
No.
Okay, thank you.
It's very hard for me to just go over a porcupine of arguments that I think I've tried to raise anywhere within the short time allowed me.
What is your position about what the status was of your client?
Well, I that's why I'm concerned. My position is multifold.
Well, what was it before the trial court?
It was that he was a caretaker, he was a tenant, and the two are interrelated, that he was also a ward of a trust administered by the personal representative of the estate, Theodore Parsons, who occupied a twofold role, one personal representative, two trustee. Mr. Parsons, the brother, occupied a rather substantial position of superiority and dominance over Christopher Parsons.
And in the record, it appeared that you did argue he was a caretaker, certainly, and he is a ward of the trust. But I did not believe you argued he was a tenant.
I don't know that I had to particularly, because it was the assertion, as evidenced by the record, Mr. Ted Parsons, that he was a tenant at will, and that is in the record.
Well, let's assume he was a tenant for purposes of this discussion, tenant at will, whatever. The condition of the roof, was that not open and obvious?
I think that's a jury question.
Why?
I think that's fundamentally a jury question. I don't. Does the court say, as a matter of law, it was?
Well, in a summary judgment motion, we usually look at the evidence that's submitted in behalf of the motion and in response to it. So my question is, did you contest that the condition of the roof was other than open and obvious at the oral summary judgment hearing? The trial court indicated that wasn't an issue.
Well, I guess I'm trying to say is, even if it were open and obvious, that's somewhat compromised by what is in the record, that Theodore Parsons said, go on up the roof and fix it. Now, implicit, to me at least, in that mandate is thinking that this was not an open and obvious danger or problematical condition.
I don't follow that logic.
Well, it makes Mr. Theodore Parson an accomplice to the act of going up onto the roof, which we're now saying is our plaintiff defendant says is a dangerous condition.
Well, this is the instruction to go up on the roof. That is the essence of your case, is it not? I mean, in other words, the fundamental situation here is that your client was living in this somewhat dilapidated house, upon which I gather it's agreed that trees had fallen on the roof, requiring that something be done in order to prevent rain from falling into the house, which is obviously not a desirable or a habitable condition for the house. Okay, so So your client had lived there for a long time, and he'd done a lot of repairs, and looks like that was kind of the ordinary course of business, is that he would basically undertake repairs, pay for them, do them himself, and without much interaction with the estate or anybody else who might own the property. And then this happened. So this, what this was that he was living there, and the trees had fallen, people knew that, but everybody knew that the trees had fallen and there was damage to the roof, okay? But he decided that it needed professional roofing repair. That was his opinion. He called up Mr. Theodore Parsons and said that. He said, I think you should get a roofer. And Theodore Parsons said, fix it yourself. And so it's your contention that by telling him to fix it himself, he breached a duty.
Yes.
All right. That's your essential position. And so the search of your case is, what duty did Mr. Theodore Parsons breach? Did he breach a duty as an employer? Did he breach a duty as a landlord? Did he breach a duty as a possessor of land, et cetera? Okay. So there's various arguments that are made about each one of those things. And then belatedly, did he breach some kind of a fiduciary duty? But let's just stick to the basic, the way that Judge Inveen was seeing it. This is a personal injury case. What is the duty that's owed? So I guess to get right to where I see the case is that it seems to me your best argument would be that, you know, if he is a tenant and if the estate is the landlord, then do they have a duty, since it's a residential, it's a residence, do they have a duty to make it habitable? All right, so if they did have such a duty, I'm wondering whether you ever made that argument, because we've got arguments about possessor of land, which is a common law duty, and then there's the argument that, well, he wasn't. The estate wasn't the possessor of land because Mr. Your client, Christopher Parsons?
Christopher.
Was occupying it.
I believe I did make that argument, but I'm confident that you've reviewed the material better than I can speak to right now. But this would have been my argument. I hope I made that argument. Sorry, I'm always.
Yeah, you're
okay. It's like a cattle prod. I'm sorry.
Well, we don't aim to really.
But
it does run on.
I thank you. I'll be back.
All Thanks. Right. Very good.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Lisa Likas on behalf of the respondent, the estate of Helen Parsons.
You see where our interests lie?
I do, so hopefully I can address that. And if not, please direct me with your questions. This is a personal injury action. That's how it was pled, which is obvious from the complaint.
I don't think we need to hear a lot about fiduciary duty.
Perfect. I don't need to go there then.
All right.
Then in that regard, then I'll move on. As far as the status of Mr. Parsons, the appellant, it's interesting. Basically what we did, or what I did in the summary judgment motion, is said, okay, assuming that he is an invitee, which is owed the highest duty possible, we still win. And the reason is that, number one, well, first reason, I guess, I'm getting ahead of myself, is that we have to be liable in the premises liability, there has to be possession. And this is actual possession. And if you review all the facts, it's there's no material issue here whether the estate actually possessed the property. The individual, Mr.
And that's old law, right? I mean, I don't mean old in a pejorative sense, but it's always been the case. Like if you lease out a house or something to somebody and it falls into disrepair, that's their problem. Right, I mean, the fact that you happen to be the owner, if they're actually occupying it, they're supposed to fix everything. They're not supposed to call you up and say, fix it. Right?
Well,
is that the idea? I mean, I'm just trying to understand.
Well, that's the idea, because the person who's in possession is going to have the best knowledge and best ability to fix the problems that arise.
So we know that's not the case, though, if you're functioning under the Landlord-Tenant Act.
Okay, if you're functioning in the landlord
residence, I mean, if you're living in a place and the roof falls in, you know, you're not on your own.
Was the Residential Landlord Tenant Act argued in this case or pled?
No, it was not pled. And in the response brief, they brought up, oh, he's a tenant. Okay, so that's kind of along the common law. And then in the reply brief, we said, all right, if he's a tenant, if anything, he's a tenant at will. And when they ejected him from the estate a year or so, a couple years later, that's what they had to plead, they, meaning the estate, that he's a tenant at will, we have to do an injectment. So if he's a tenant at will, the Residential Landlord-Tenant Act doesn't apply. I don't think the habitability of this premises is an issue, because the only issue is the roof, and he climbed up on the roof. Now, it was leaking, okay, but the roof had leaked, you know, when Grandma still lived in the house. That's in the record. It had always leaked. Did the leak get worse after the 2006 storm? Okay, yeah. Tarps were put on it, and throughout all these years, appellant climbed up that roof, and he replaced those tarps. So
it's your feeling that since he had been satisfied to live in a leaky house, he should have been continued to live in a leaky house.
Well, he didn't have to live there. That's the whole point of this. He's a tenant at will.
Nobody ever has to live, I guess, in a leaky house. You can always move, but nevertheless, the law does seem to offer some protection to people who are living in uninhabitable conditions.
Well, but who's saying it's uninhabitable? So,
he called up, but this is what strikes me about your brief is that I don't see any response to the fundamental situation where he calls up and he says, I think the roof needs professional repair. And your client says, well, fix it yourself. And then you come back and say, well, he had options. He could have had it repaired and sent us the bill. That seems to me to be an unavailable inference from the fact that you told him to fix it himself.
Well, for summary judgment purposes, we had to accept that particular fact as true, which we did a little footnote in our motion for summary judgment brief that those facts that he testified to regarding statements that my client said, okay, assuming he did say, fix it yourself. Well, number one, he's the caretaker, right? Quote, unquote, he's been there for 20 years. This is something he's did for 20 years. And it's like, fine, so what? He climbed up on the roof, and if you look at the record, clerk's papers, page 20, you know, he didn't trip on a nail. He didn't trip on moss, slip on moss, or a loose shingle. No, he misstepped. That's why
What difference would it make if he had slipped on a nail? I mean,
well, then that would be, quote, maybe a defect in the roof. And then
that
if there
would take
was
you into what area?
Well,
of law?
If there was a defect in the roof, then the issue then comes even more so. Was this open and obvious? Is this something that he knew about? And that's just what we're saying, is that even assuming that the estate possessed this house, which we don't think the evidence shows that, then the next step is, okay, then what's his status? Is he an invitee? Let's assume for argument he's an invitee. I think he's more likely going to be a licensee as a family member living in the house, but to win summary judgment, we said, okay, for sake of argument, then he is going to be an invitee, and then this is an open, obvious condition. We don't have a duty to warn.
And then for purposes of summary judgment, you argued, assuming he's a tenant at will, habitability doesn't apply because the Landlord-Tenant Act doesn't apply. Was that your position?
That was our position at the oral argument, right. Tenant at will, basically that was also came up because of this argument that,
did,
you know,
did the Landlord-Tenant Act come up in the oral argument?
Just that whole little sentence that the Landlord-Tenant Act doesn't apply because he's a tenant at will. I mean, it wasn't discussed in any great depth. It wasn't briefed.
And it wasn't pled.
And that's kind
but
of
is
what
the statute clear? Does the statute support your position?
I don't
believe. It doesn't apply to, that the Landlord-Tenant Act doesn't apply to an at will.
A case does. There's a couple of cases, and I'm sorry, I don't have those
okay.
in front of me
That's
now.
Fine.
But no, the Landlord-Tenant Act, I don't think it actually says that. But
so there's case law.
The case law that says that.
Well, you don't have to look.
I can probably find it if I had to. I apologize.
Well, if it's in your brief, we'll find it.
I don't think it is.
Well, it's going to be the Nazewitz, Najewitz,
okay.
21 Washington 2nd, 656.
You've cited that. We're aware of that case.
Okay.
Thank you.
So, but again, this wasn't pled. Then I don't know. This is, well, premises liability. I think the fact that if Mr. Parsons said, hey, go fix it yourself.
Well, I mean, premises liability, he's living there. That's what I keep coming back to. I mean, this isn't an invitee. This isn't the mailman. You know, this isn't a delivery person. This isn't your cousin who's or your friend from across town who's coming to visit you for a party. This is somebody who's living there on your land, right? I mean, that is the truth of the situation. You own it. He's living there.
At the time, the estate eventually gained ownership of the property. It wasn't deeded correctly. That's mentioned in the brief, but yes.
Well, who did own it if the estate didn't own it?
Well, actually, it was the grandfather at the time. The Theodore Parsons.
He wasn't alive when the
session. He wasn't alive.
So somebody else owned it.
Then it went to his wife. And then.
So we're getting a technical ownership argument here, right. But
no,
for purposes of summary judgment, isn't it fair to say
yes,
that
we owned it?
Whoever you represent is
the estate of Helen Parsons. We owned it,
Mr. Christopher Parsons, the plaintiff here, didn't own it.
He did not own it.
Somebody else in the family owned it.
And well, the estate only the estate owned it, okay. And he is a beneficiary of the estate.
Right.
And then just to clarify this, you know, a ward of the estate. He's not a ward of the estate of Helen Parsons. He's a ward of the estate of Phyllis Parsons. So that gets all to that fiduciary duty argument that we're not going to discuss. So I just wanted to clarify that.
Right.
So there's a lot of Parsons.
So premises liability. I mean, how can premises liability apply to somebody who's living in a place? Is that?
Well, I don't think it does. And that's why we argued that these are the cause of actions that they pled. Common law, premises liability, general contractor, employer-employee, and then this whole common law workplace safety. I think it's pretty clear that it is clear. You know, the estate's not a general contractor, doesn't meet the definition. The estate's not an employer, doesn't meet the definition. The estate's a homeowner, and this heir to the estate.
But the estate is a landlord, isn't that fair to say? They own it, he lives there.
But he wasn't being charged any rent. So it's this whole tenancy at will thing that it's murky. I don't know if we're landlord, but even if the estate is going to be a homeowner and a landlord and this guy's living there.
He was doing work and not getting paid for it. So, I mean, it's kind of an informal arrangement, isn't it? I'll live here and take care of it if you let me live here.
Correct.
That's kind of the setup.
And that's what he was doing at the time. And so we get into this situation. Well, yeah, but it's just.
It's murky, isn't it?
Well, it's bizarre, yeah. And you get into.
You've used your time.
All right, thank you. We'd ask that you just affirm the trial court's decision. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Hamilton.
Well, just because it's bizarre doesn't mean we don't need to move towards resolution. The Najwitz case mentioned as saying the Landlord-Tenant Act doesn't apply.
Right.
The opinion came out in 1944, well before the Landlord-Tenant Act was even commenced. And in fact, I've noted in my brief the one exception to the Landlord Tenant Act, which says, well, we don't cover this, and that relates to a person who's an employee, and then we get back to the issue of do we have an employer-employee relationship? And so here again, the cloud just gets thicker over this case. Because we don't know, it's hard to tell what is the role of the landlord, the owner, the personal representative, and we have, I don't think, respectfully, we can ignore the fact that Mr. Theodore Parsons has the statutory duties of a personal representative of the estate. This, and I don't do a lot of probate work, but this certainly was a very languid
The trial court made very clear in giving the oral decision that this was a personal injury action, not a breach of fiduciary duty action, not a TEDRA action, nothing more than a personal injury action.
And I'm fine with that. That doesn't mean that the statutory duties of the personal representative disappear. It just means we ignore
the... What statutory duties are you talking about? Other than your allegation that there's a landlord-tenant relationship here?
No, I've set out in my brief that the two components of the 1140... I can't give it to you off the top of my head. But the obligation to settle quickly, the obligation to maintain tenantable premises, these are statutory obligations incumbent on the personal representative. Whether we call them fiduciary or not, practically, it doesn't make any difference. It's still a breach of a statutory duty to maintain a tenantable residence.
You didn't plead that.
I didn't plead anything. I can't after someone. Okay. Well, it doesn't matter.
Your client did not plead it. And as so far as I can determine, there was one or two sentences devoted to this topic in oral argument. In terms of fleshing out a duty of a landlord to maintain habitable living conditions.
Nonetheless, it was there, however microscopic you may find it to be. There's been no abandonment of any of these arguments that I'm making now. The fundamental flaw, if you will, is the pleading.
An argument that you haven't made.
Well, I think we have made the arguments. That's why I'm what I'm trying to say. And I know I'm taxing your patience here, but
you have used your time.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Our last case today will be Caldwell versus City of Hoquiam. Please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Excuse me, I've got a bit of a cold. May please.